And here we go again with another episode of The Way I Heard It, specifically number 324. This one's called Bonus Day with Jedediah Thurner. To be clear, Chuck, not a bonus episode, but a bonus day. Pourquoi?
Well, he gets very real at one point and talks about a near-death experience. And after that near-death experience, every day seemed like a bonus day after that.
That's exactly what happened in our completely unscripted conversation. Hey, it's something that we've all experienced, you know. All of a sudden, you like survive a near-death experience, and suddenly everything smells a little better, tastes a little better, you know. It's a sensation that's always interested me, and Jedediah Thurner is a guy who is living pretty much every day like it's a bonus day. He's in charge of a nonprofit called Love Has No Limits. And if you haven't heard of these guys, I bet you will. If you remember Returning the Favor, this guy is like the father of all bloody do-gooders. He did something that I tried to do, you know, on a modest scale. But he's doing events, Chuck, that, I mean, frankly, I find him kind of intimidating.
Yeah. I mean, he did an event in L.A., I think in 2021, called One Day L.A., where he brought together a bunch of faith-based organizations, NGOs, all these people with charities. And he's like a force multiplier. Love Has No Limits brings people together, and they bring together volunteers, tens of thousands of volunteers. And in fact, they bring together A-list talent like Justin Bieber, and then they put on a concert for the people who have volunteered. You can't buy a ticket to the concert. You got to come and spend some time with some of these organizations helping to solve the problems of LA in that day. And then you get entry into this concert. And it was a huge success.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a success everywhere. They just did one in Houston, raised over $100 million. And the money goes straight to families in crisis. So basically, all the guy's trying to do is solve poverty, homelessness, get an overburdened child welfare system turned around. Mm. And he's doing it by rallying local businesses and faith communities and nonprofits and government and NGOs. It's basically George Bush's 1,000 points of light. And he's connecting them. And he's actually moving the needle. The guy, look, he's a man of faith, but he is completely engaged in this effort to take, if you remember Returning the Favor, it's the best way I can think of to say it. He's putting Returning the Favor on steroids, and he's bringing it to places like Miami and Houston and New York and Chicago and, of course, L.A. He launched this thing at the height of the lockdowns. So
crazy.
He's not intimidated by the degree of difficulty. He's a guy who got on my radar because Charles Koch and the Stand Together organization is firmly behind Love Has No Limits in much the same way they're behind MicroWorks. So again, I'm finding a deep well of really interesting people over in this community who I think you should know. And Jedediah Thurner is the latest. Love Has No Limits. Episode number 324. It's a great conversation. I know you're going to love him, and it all happens right after this.
Really love great people, you know, and so it's awesome to spend some moments with you, and thank you for all the stuff you've done for, I think, humanity and obviously for Americans and a lot of undervalued, overlooked, you know, positions. So just thank you for, I'm just getting to learn all of some of the foundation
Jedediah,
stuff
you're
too,
killing me. What a tragedy that we weren't rolling 5 seconds earlier when people could have heard this amazing compliment paid to me from this amazing dude.
I could say
Jedediah Thurner. No, look, that's okay.
The truth is easy to repeat. The lie is where we have a problem.
So true.
Well, then let's start by repeating the remarkable analogy you shared with me vis-a-vis my dog, Freddie, and your youngster, both of whom just run off and do whatever they want with no real understanding of what the consequences might be. What is going on with the dog and the human condition in these divided times, Jedediah?
I think there's a lot of parallels to the nature and behavior of animals and the refined version of them called humans. And unfortunately, my three-year-old and Freddie, your dog, find themselves in the same category of basically doing whatever they want, whenever they want to do it. And there's nothing we could do it about it. But thank God they make us feel good at the end of the day. you know? And so we continue to take them on walks and pick up their crap, right?
Yes. Just so the listener understands, I was a little tardy because my dog, he got it into his puppy brain that there was something more interesting off property. So he left the reservation just before I got in the shower, and suddenly I'm half naked, running through an otherwise very civilized zip code, screaming my dog's name. And Jedediah's point was, you know something? The dog has run a calculus. He has, through years of experience, determined the consequences for a certain set of behaviors. And human beings do the exact same things. And in this way, we seem to be so predictable, Jedediah. And I think this is a good jumping off point, because so much of your good work is rooted in changing the patterns of people and getting them to see, you're right, cause and effect, that causation is not necessarily the same as correlation, and that we can change path that we're on.
Well, you said a lot there.
I did.
He never says a little. He never says a little, Jedediah.
I'm thinking about whose behavior are we talking about? My sons, your dogs, or our response to them, right? Because I saw little Freddie on your lap getting tongue kissed, you know, in essence. And he was like,
come on, man. Don't make it weird.
How severe is the... I mean, you guys didn't witness what I saw. I wish you could see it. You know, we might put it on Facebook or YouTube. But there's a lot of love after this disappointing decision, you know, that, you know, there's a lot of comeback. I think, you
and
know...
relief. Like, and relief.
And relief.
Right.
I think what's maybe how we can connect the dots is, I do think we have a capacity, and we should, to believe in people, right? I think that's why you're believing in your dog. We're believing our son. My son's going to make a different decision the next day, right? Mm-hmm. And what we're hoping we're doing is providing enough capabilities or support or understanding and perspective shift so that they will. And because we are all flawed and fractured and failed at some component of our life, we're hoping that if they eventually make the right decision one day, we will too, right? That's probably what's going on in the journey. But I do think people, when given the opportunity, are capable of incredible things. And that's probably what I like to figure out how to do, is give people more opportunity to be incredible of capable things instead of talking about what they can't.
Well, it's hope, right? It's hope. You know, we put our hope in our dogs, we put our hope in our families, we put our hope in our friends, and we put our hope in ourselves. And look, I'll just return the compliment, even though my listeners didn't really hear the full extent of your largesse, but you are, I think, maybe one of the greatest bloody do-gooders that I've come across. And I say that as a guy who, it's not so much a compliment as it is a really sincere observation. And I'm not an expert in this area, but after 100 episodes of Returning the Favor, I've met a lot of people who have dedicated their platform, their influence, their life, their breath to making a difference in their zip code. Now, you, my friend, have taken it to the next level. So I want to hear about Love Has No Limits, because I was under the impression that everything was ultimately limited in some way. But you actually seem to be proving it. Your events are enormous. You're returning favors on a gargantuan scale. So just kind of give me the background, if you would, and then maybe if you could sum up, how in the world have you managed to move the needle in so many ways so far?
Yeah, super kind words. And I'd say, especially to our listening audience, because this is what would be important to me, I think the challenge even about this conversation is I have to do the talking. You know, and it would be foolish for any of their listeners to think that the hero or the hope of city transformation or bottom-up empowerment or solving the greatest problems facing our families and our communities would be because of one individual or group of individuals. And if someone were to look at us and say, oh, you guys did it, that would be the antithesis of what we're trying to do, right? The goal would be that no one thinks we did it. The goal would be that there's a whole other bunch of people that agree in a unifying narrative that hate's not working and never has and it never will, and love's the only thing that could work. And their efforts and their humility and their desire to collaborate and their desire to sacrifice and take time to not just make a living and make a difference, that's what really matters, you know? So the great news is that if you're listening, you have the opportunity to be the hero of the story, because the hero of the story is not the guys talking right now. I just say it, you know, and I think that's what you've done so well, Mike, with all the different things you've ventured off into. You've never pointed it to you, your name's on it, but you're pointing it to all these other people. And I think in that we would be extremely parallel. The heroes are the people that are actually doing this work day in and day out. And I think some of my journey is I never thought I'd be on this side of the conversation. I never thought I'd be doing this. You know, I grew up a poor missionary's kid. My parents are my heroes. They're still alive. I lived in 100 homes before I was 20 years old. Not an exaggeration. Thank God they picked sunny locations to live out their faith and their belief system. I always told my mom, I was like, you went running to Hawaii and Tahiti and Costa Rica, but you said no to Ohio and no chance to Michigan and, you know, shut down the door to Alaska. Like, it is like you didn't never went to the back 40, you know, like it was such a different, right. You know, so I grew up in all the Hawaiian islands, but Kauai, I literally lived in every city in Maui, but Hana. Lived in Tahiti, New Zealand, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Miami. I was born in Seattle, never claimed it till the Seahawks started winning. I did a couple stints in California. And to be honest, for me, my journey was one of, by the time I got to call or was leaving high school, I just didn't want to be poor. Like, to be honest, like that was the primary objective. Now, I wanted to play professional sports. I got a scholarship to play football. I was the first one in my entire family, including my parents of seven, to go to college. I was the first one in my family to graduate from college. Still, I was the first one in my family to own a home at 23. I had the privilege of being successful, you know, relative to success young, and was able to buy my parents a home at 25 years old, give them a $400,000 home. And I was doing all the things I wanted to do. You know, when I met my wife, she basically said she didn't want to really be married to anyone connected to charity or philanthropy or ministry, basically no one that was going to be asking people for money. She just wanted to be, you know, part of a family that was able to give money. And I was like, that's what we're going to do. And we set out to do it. And I think the what's comical about this conversation is the stuff we do now, and maybe the laugh of sacrifice was at that stage back in the day a nightmare. It was like, this is what we never would want to do. This is what we'll never find ourselves doing. And I think at that stage in the life, we had some stuff that I never had growing up. And I remember one morning waking up being like, if you add more zeros or more square footage or more cars or more possessions, like what changes? You know, like I got the stuff that I never thought we would ever have. I finally own stuff.
When did you realize you weren't poor, Jedediah? Do you remember? Like one day you wake
up. Such a great question. You got like, when you said the words, Mike, I don't know why I got really emotional. Like here's what I realized. I didn't realize I knew we didn't have stuff. And my parents provided endlessly and sacrificed. My dad worked multiple jobs, hitchhiked when he didn't have cars. Like the work ethic was unbelievable. And he was a pastor and a minister. I think when I realized I was poor, and this was when I was no longer poor, but I realized I actually had poverty behind me, was when I would go to grocery stores, like regular Ralph's and, you know, just a regular grocery store, and I'd be gone for an hour and a half. And my wife would go, I sent you to buy milk and eggs and bread. And she's like, what are you doing? And guys, this is a true story. I would just buy stuff on sale, discounts. I'd be coming back with mops. And I mean, I would just buy so much stuff every time I go to the store. And she was like, what are you doing? And it hit me. Like, it was months of, she's like, you go to the store, you come back with, literally, you spent $400 at a grocery store, and like 20% of the items were food. So I was just buying all the rent, like the candles and a grill thing. And she's like, what are you doing? And then it hit me. I never could buy anything going to the store as a kid. We didn't buy stuff. We shop for a period of time. We bought, and thank God we could buy anything, right? There's other people listening to this. They couldn't buy anything. But we bought what we were going to eat that day and nothing more. And we went to the store every day to buy what we were going to get that day. And there was no running around being like, hey, can you throw this in the cart? Or this is really cool. Or can I get the bouncy ball? Or what about this loofah? Because I want to get creative with my bath time. Like, I didn't, it was like, there's.
Well, it's such a great answer because it proves a thing that I've always suspected, which is you can sweep stuff under the rug and you can delay all sorts of things, you know, virtue and vice, gratification and greed. But it's going to come out at some point. And all those years bottled up of not being able to get what you want translates into, honey, can you pick up some milk and eggs and you come home with aromatherapy candles? And a magic eight ball. I mean, it's just great.
That's exactly what I was doing, you know? And I think so to get to the changes, I think one day I woke up and, you know, I'd use words providence or, you know, divine. Like I do believe in that, but I got a lot of margin for people to put 1,000 different words there or different entities there. Mm-hmm. But for me, I remember like the challenge was at this stage of now founding success that your family hasn't had, none of your siblings have had, I'm the second youngest. If every dream came true now or every prayer that you prayed got answered now, what would change? And I remember that moment being like, my life would change, but no one else's would. If my prayers got answered, if my dreams came true, my life would get better. The world would stay the same. My life would advance and, you know, my family and my legacy would be different, but I wouldn't be helping anyone else. And I remember that was the challenge where it was no longer about generating revenue or making a living. It was about how are we really going to make a difference. And I think if you're going to do good, my desire is when you started saying some stuff in the beginning about maybe some of the scale that we've been connected to, I'm just like, if we're going to do good, why not do it the best way possible? You know, and at the end of the day, I don't think, and I've learned this from being a missions kid, right? Because what you have is a lot of people that are doing good, but not the best way possible. And you get away with continuing to do a bad version of a good thing because you're trying to do a good thing. That is an unhealthy perspective that perpetuates a model or a framework of serving others that actually never gets them out of the thing you're trying to serve them through.
Yeah. Forgive me for jotting as you're talking, but I'm going to forget some things. And that, like, before we get to the big, big stuff, like the macro, there's right. the micro, no pun intended. And I want to know what it felt like for you to buy your parents a house. Right.
Man, I mean, not, really, I did. What are we? Are we on Oprah today? Like, are we on Oprah?
Well, look,
if you can't see my eyes, people, like, ah.
No, look, it matters to me because I had the privilege of doing something very similar. Not because my parents couldn't have swung it on their own, but because they wouldn't leave the home that we were all more or less raised in. And it was time. And I was very fortunate to be in a position where I could get a place and then go to my dad and say, look, the only way he would ever leave that house and go into another house is if his son said, I'm going to lose all the money if you don't move into it. You know, and it wasn't a lot of money.
Smart.
Doesn't matter. He's my dad. It's just a little bit of money is right. enough. Right. So they're right. like, okay, we'll do it. And when I look back, man, that was a much bigger day for me than I thought it was at the time. Mm. So before we get to the hundreds of thousands of people that your organization's impacted, what was it like to do a solid for your folks?
I think, I think I'm still trying to do that every day, right? Like, if I'm being honest, I'm trying to, when I joined this organization, one of the things we committed to each other, you know, my best friends that we run it together, is giving our parents their best decade. It was actually a part of our conversation. So we said, hey, we're going to do this thing and we're going to execute on these outcomes. But if our parents and some of our parents were in ministry, some of them were maybe at seasons of not success, we're just so committed to our moms and dads having their most fruitful, blessed years. And it's probably because we have parents who did it all for the right reasons and gave everything. And to be honest, no one showed them a better model. The only reason why my parents didn't own a home sooner is because the ministry they were a part of didn't say it was valuable. Like, why would you do it? So if they were told, I mean, we grew up in Hawaii. If we bought one house, they would have been millionaires. They did not buy a house because they were stupid. They didn't buy a house because the community they were part of didn't find that owning something was valuable. You know, so like I would defend them, and they were doing it not because maybe at times they didn't have the capacity, but, you know, they could have gotten help or support. I think for me, Mike, I've never been asked that question. So that's probably why I got emotional. No one in my entire life has ever asked, what did it feel like? So when you hit me, I felt the feelings. I think what I have more emotion around was the conversation before, you know, like the conversation before with my dad, and my dad's my hero. He's 73 as of last week. My mom's turning 79 this year, and they're just the best humans. And my dad's just, and he just taught me, I love him. You know, he's one of my best friends. And, you know, my whole life I grew up with a reinforcing narrative of poverty that we just didn't know that was happening. And the narrative that my dad would say over and over again, as my sister needed stuff or my older siblings needed stuff, he would look at me because I was more like him and be like, hey, I won't eat my lunch for a month to get my shoes for basketball, which I did. Eighth grade, didn't eat lunch for a month, save money so I could buy my first pair of shoes to alleviate the pressure on my dad. Like, I didn't want him to have that pressure. And so I remember my whole life, he would say, yeah, all we need is 3 squares a day, a roof over our head, and clothes on our body. Like, he'd say it all the time. And so when I looked at any need that was beyond that, we would look at each other, and it was almost like this prideful humility, and go, Dad, you know, I mean, I'd said it my whole life, high school a lot, because my sister was like trying to spend money in prom dresses, and she just loves spending money. And I'd be, Dad, this is crazy. You know, all we need is a roof over our head, 3 meals a day, clothes on our body. And before we were letting him know about this house opportunity, he was sitting in another house we owned, second house we had bought. And I told my dad at a dinner table, I said, hey, Dad, I just want to let you know. And we're talking about life and changes, and you've grown. And he's just honoring, like, hey, you think different than you used to. And I said, hey, Dad, just want to let you know, like, you were wrong. It's my exact words, Mike. I go, you were wrong. And he goes, excuse me? It's not words I've said to him often, you know? Mm-hmm. He's like, you were wrong. Excuse me. And I said, Dad, my whole life you said all we needed was a roof over our head, you know, 3 meals a day and clothes on our body. And we wore that like a badge of honor. And I go, you were wrong. Because if that's all you have nothing for anyone else. I go, I know you created that narrative to be selfless, but it actually within its framework is selfish. Because all you're going to have is a place to sleep and food to eat and clothes to cover your body, but you won't have a meal to share, a room to lend to someone else, and you have no capital to give to a cause that could help. And I really, and that was probably the more emotional moment, is that I had a, in an act of generosity, I still had to challenge a mindset of poverty. Because at the end of the day, I don't want you to just think this house is all you need. Because then again, it's still going to become a selfish, self-fulfilling prophecy, is all I need is all I have. And for me, the point of any income or any success is to have more impact, right? It's like, so the more money we can generate, or the more volunteer power you can garnish, or the more awareness you can have, it's not to build a brand, it's to build a movement. And if we make more, we can do more, you know? And so, yeah, sure. Sorry, man, you got me through a little emotional journey there.
Hey, look, I'm sorry to come out hot like that, but I'm not asking you anything I haven't asked myself ever since returning the favor came and went. Mm. I've been so personally interested in such a long time, not in good people versus less good people, but in why good people do what they do. Mm. I don't know, is it the sixth commandment? Honor thy father and mother, right? Is it the sixth?
I don't know the numerically. I don't know the number, but it's in there. You know,
It's in the top 10.
Yeah, for sure.
But again, it's back to the scale 10. Of it.
I just got it. It's in the top 10, guys. There's only 10 if you didn't know.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah. It's that great scene in, what is it, Chuck, History of the World, when Moses is coming down from Sinai and he's got 3 tablets. And he says, I bring you these 15. And one slips out of his hand and breaks. 10.
Oi.
These 10 oi. Commandments.
You forgot the oi. He goes, oi.
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 10
oi.
Commandments. Yeah, 10. It's number 5. Honor thy father and mother is number 5.
Thank you.
I just looked it up.
Thank you.
That's awesome.
So, yeah, I probably put the cart before the horse. Figuring out why you do what you do is not fair to the listener until we really understand what you've done. Mm. So, if you don't mind, we'll just take a hard right and look at Love Has No Limits and kind of jump ahead and tell me about LA. Tell me about Houston. Tell me what one man can do with a one day event if he checks all the right boxes.
So much to say. And thank you for asking. Yeah, I think when you think about Love Has No Limits, which it's early in its journey, you know, I think it's pretty awesome to see what's happened already, but it's early in its journey in America. You know, it's technically at this stage of recording, it's 3 years old. Now, our body of work's not 3 years old, but this expression of it is. You know, it's 3 years old in America. And if you think about Love Has No Limits, if someone listening is just going, hey, just give me a snapshot of what this thing does. Love Has No Limits, you know, really unites hundreds of nonprofits, hundreds of faith communities, alongside hundreds of businesses and entrepreneurs, alongside tens of thousands of volunteers and tier one artists and influencers, to really solve the greatest problems facing our community, you know, and it's really understanding what would it look like if we would collectively, intelligently, sustainably, and perpetuity team tackle the same problems. There's a lot, and what's the best way to bring a solution to that problem? There is, you know, millions of nonprofits in America. There's hundreds of thousands of people trying to do good, but we often don't work with each other. We don't know each other. We don't talk to each other. And I think love has no limits. Why that wording or phraseology is for us, we just, the time we're all living in, right? I mean, read the news, look at your Twitter feed, look at Instagram, you know, especially in the time of Love Has No Limits really being birthed in 2019, you know, hate was front and center stage, and I don't think it's going anywhere. And the nation was divided like it's never been before, and homes that would have happy holidays were hurting and torn apart. And we just sat there. My consensus, which I kind of say everywhere, is hate's not working. Like, in case you didn't know, in case you haven't taken a step, if you're listening and you've never just paused to take a step back at the narrative, hate has never worked. It never has, and it never will. It is a horrible return on investment. And what is the antithesis of hate? It's love. You know, love's the only thing that can bring us together. Love's the only thing that would allow us to listen to a person we don't want to pay attention to. Love would be the only thing that would cause us to drive the extra mile, give the extra buck, you know, sacrifice that extra step. Like, this is this only, and it's a universal word and a part of culture everywhere that everyone can resonate with. You know, when we're thinking about what we would call this movement and this entity, this expression, you know, a lot of people refer to us as Love Without Limits. They say it all the time. These are the Love Without Limits guys, you know, and we would actually be like, actually, no, it's not us loving without limits. It's a declaration and it's a statement. It's a definitive truth to us that actually love has no limits. And if you study human history, the best version of that love does break every barrier, builds every bridge, removes every wall, and reconciles narratives and lives and marriages and families and cities and countries that never thought could be reconciled, right? So that's the version of it. And, you know, so it's love without limits. And we looked at, you know, how do we want to make a difference? We had to figure out what's really plaguing our communities. You know, back in the old days, people would do outreach or social good out of great ideas, right? Like, that's how we used to do it. I got a great idea, put a brand on it, let's market it, let's raise money, let's do it, and it's awesome. But we're like, hey, we're in a, you know, the technological age, why aren't we doing outreach and social good out of great information? Like, we call it intelligent outreach or data-driven outreach, you know, like, let's be intelligent. And so we actually, you know, hired some scientists and some surveyors and found out what was really going on in America. And what we've come to realize, like, I'll be honest with this audience, what we realize, which a lot of people don't want to hear, and this is just the stats. This is not Jedediah or Love Has No Limits perspective. This is just what the data would tell us, that the number one root cause of all of the issues that we see, so whether that's incarceration or corruption or violence or poverty or homelessness or human trafficking or child welfare, you know, it's teenage pregnancy, whatever it is, the root cause of all of these problems is actually fatherlessness. Fatherlessness is actually the root cause. Now, man, that is something hard to take on, hard for any individual movement to conquer. And fatherlessness creates families in crisis. Now, there's families in crisis that have fathers, so it's not the only indicator of a family in crisis, but 70% of families in crisis have some sort of dysfunction around this father figure, whether he's present but not present, whether he's absent completely. And so for us, we realized that if we were going to make a difference in these outcomes, that we really wanted to focus on families in crisis. So when you think about every major issue facing our cities, our communities, it's because the family is in crisis, period. Now, that could be because that family is struggling with poverty, or that family isn't bilingual and it speaks a different language at a first language. It could be because there's no financial literacy. It could be because there's a broken home. You know, there's addiction. So many. It could be because addiction, exactly. It could be because they're refugees that got, you know, migrated from war-torn cities. Like, there's a thousand things that create a family in crisis, but that's where you want to enter into the conversation. Because when there's a family in crisis, it leads to neglect and abuse. Neglect and abuse funnels hundreds of thousands of kids annually into an overburdened child welfare system. That's just one of the verticals. And that child welfare system, ladies and gentlemen, becomes a statistical cesspool of the worst of the fruit in America, and most people don't know it. You know, 56% of all female foster youth that age out of the system will be pregnant by 21 without a partner present. 40% of all foster youth that age out of the system will be homeless within 2 years, not could be or should be. There's about 100,000 boys and girls in America right now being trafficked within our borders. I hate to say it. It's just a reality. I live with this stuff every day. 100,000 of our boys and girls within our borders are trafficked into human slavery every year. 70,000 of them are directly connected to foster care homes or group homes. 60% of all men in prison spend time in child welfare. 60% of the incarcerated individual. So when you just think about, hey, when we're talking about Love Has No Limits, it's if we're going to make a difference, as I said, if we're going to do good, let's do the best version of it. And let's make sure that we're actually solving the root of the problem, not just the fruit of the root. And so that's
the symptom, right?
The symptom.
A cause and a symptom. I appreciate you saying the thing about fatherhood, because I know how politicized everything can become today.
Right?
And I know how a lot of people will hear a different thing, but we just can't shy away from the underlying problems, you know,
and that doesn't neglect the, I want to say for women listeners, like, I know the challenges with that statement, because what about all the single moms that are raising these kids? What about everyone that was a massive radical success that grew up without a dad? You know, like there's so many, you know, what we do need to know is, it is a part of the problem, and it would be ignorant of us if we really want to see a greater America and win the war for the future of our children's children to not at least consider it being a cause and effect. And then if you can't wrap your head around a male or that identity or that relationship framework, which I completely have margin for, well, let's focus on families in crisis, which have a lot of different definitions and descriptions, but that's the next layer, right?
So how do you reach them? How do you reach the family in a way that is persuasive? And by that, and tell me if you think I'm out of my lane or wrong up, but I feel like the barriers that go up with people today typically happen sometimes when they hear a term that they don't like or a turn of phrase that they don't like. Right. But mostly it's when they sense a lecture or a sermon. And I use those words because they're two very different things. And look, when I was in school, I enjoyed lectures. When I'm in church, I enjoy a sermon. And by the way, I've heard your work. You are extraordinary in that medium. But out in the world, out in LA, in Houston, how do you not lecture? How do you not sermon in a way that resonates with the families who are really in need, in crisis?
Yeah, I think that it's a really great question. I mean, if I was to maybe give the listeners like some context for LA, because we have talked around it and then we get into it. You know, so LA was, you know, was in the heart of the Delta variant. You know, we launched this campaign in COVID. If you don't remember, if you lived in Los Angeles, it wasn't the most friendly towards COVID restrictions. The governor, the mayor.
You don't say.
And don't say. You're getting tickets, you know, walking out the streets. And to be honest, all of our surfing and all of our NGO partners, like their doors were closed. To be honest, guys, if I'm being honest, no one was doing anything. The county was shut up. Like we were in all these conversations. No one knew what we didn't know what to do. No one knew what to do and how to do it. And this is when we felt we were supposed to launch, you know, really this movement. And the narrative was what the narrative we shared. Like we didn't start off by saying, hey, let's rescue families or empower families in crisis. Cause what we've realized, guys, is a lot of people don't want to ever drill down to the problem. We're just presenting this, what we would call this unifying narrative that different groups and different beliefs and different spheres of influence could rally around. Like people aren't going to connect with each other, but they'll connect with the cause or the narrative. And so for us, that was hate's not working. You know, love's our only option. And what would it look like? Frederick Douglass 101. What would it look like? What would be the potential, the possibility if we'd be willing to unite with anyone to do good and no one to do wrong? So we didn't start off by saying, here's the problems we're going to solve. We had to create the framework, the team, the army, the infrastructure to actually serve and solve the problem first, right? So for us, it was, hey, what would it look like if this is what we would do? You unite with anyone, you know, to do good and no one to do wrong. And man, I'll be honest, like no one thought it would also work in LA, you know, with the political environment in close context. But to be honest, there's so many people that felt the tension of what wasn't working. They're in the heart of, you know, pick a side, pick a team, pick a party, pick a politician, pick a faith narrative. Like they were so exhausted with it's got to be us or them. And whose side are you on versus we're on humanity's side. And I could stand with a lot of people I disagree with because the one thing we could probably unite around is loving our neighbor. you know? So that was really what was happening in LA. And what did that manifest like? It manifest, you know, just so some people get a picture, and then we'll move back to the question, you know, is about 641 partnering organizations, it's NGOs, that's diverse faith communities. I mean, everyone from the Archdiocese to the Jewish, you know, Federation, you know, so diverse faiths that didn't work together, you know, all uniting over a common good. I think through those 641 faith communities and partners, which are the heroes of the campaign, we were able to eradicate $47 million in medical debt for 23,000 families living no more than twice the poverty line. So every family got a letter in the mail saying your debt's been forgiven on behalf of Love Has No Limits and our partners. Feel free to start your financial future. No strings attached. We were able to activate the largest recruitment campaign for foster and adoptive parents really in the history of LA County, which is pretty awesome. This was a need they had. They said, could you help us here? We have 31,000 kids stuck in child welfare in LA County. 31,000 kids, guys. And 7,000 of them are right now American legal orphans. They have no route to being with any relative or any family member. They're completely legal orphans. And only 700 of them have raised their hand and say, I'd like to pursue adoption. And the reason why is they've been rejected and dejected for so long, they can't handle potentially being said, we don't want you again. You know, so that was part of the narrative. But we had about 2,500 families step up to pursue foster and adoption, you know, in a short period of time. We were able to launch a hope community in all 35 prisons of the state of California, which for us was massive. It was an LA problem because if you do crime in LA, you do time across California. You know, you might get sentenced
right.
in LA.
Move you from LA up to Eureka.
To San Quentin, yeah, to San Quentin. And then you're going to leave there and go to a halfway house in Indio and Palm Springs. And so we basically said, how do we create a network of people that care about the incarcerated individual who's an overlooked, marginalized person who can't even vote anymore, has lost all their rights? Like, how do we make sure that if someone gets sentenced in LA, there is a community for them at that prison in San Quentin? And if they get and they leave incarceration and go to a halfway house, there's a community for them, because we just didn't want, you know, we didn't want convicts, you know, to not have community in incarceration or have to rediscover it post-incarceration, which is what's the greatest proponent to recidivism, you know? So, but the cool thing is these hope communities, they're local partnering orgs that are in proximity to the prison. They're providing community for those inmates. There is RAT classes, which for those who don't know, it reduces the life of sentence of an inmate. So right now they can take a recovery program and it reduces the life of their sentence. We have a financial peace program. It reduces the life of their sentence. We have about, I'd have to look at the numbers in the last 30 days, but there's about 35 to 4,000 inmates, you know, that are in one of these communities at these locations. So we have about at least 100 on average that are gathering every week, which is really awesome. But that was new to LA. We are able to serve about 100,000 families. Of course, in the middle of a Delta variant with a closed city, we activated an army of volunteers to say, hey, will you come serve this city to celebrate at a concert? You know, and it just happened to be the most expensive venue in America at the time, which is the SoFi. And we partnered with a kind of up-and-coming artist that some people might know, Justin Bieber, who was a part of that, and Chance the Rapper and Jaden Smith and Pink Sweats and Kid Laroi and Tori Kelly. And the cool thing is this was their give back, right? So we used that moment to say, hey, you can't buy a ticket to this concert or event. You have to actually do good, take action to get access. You have to serve to have a seat. And in 20 days, 20,000 random individuals, you know, paid money to get off their phones, out of their homes, to help people they did not know, to serve with people they did not know, to be a part of an event that night, which kind of gives some of the snapshots. You know, sorry, I just want to let some people know that was kind of some of the snapshots of what took place in LA. And how we are now saying, so the question is how do you create the story where a family wants to receive the information they need for transformation, right? To not be a family in crisis. I think part of it is making sure you're providing a holistic approach, right? And a lot of times that means it's not one organization. Like what I've learned is it takes hundreds of great organizations to actually provide enough holistic support for one individual to get out of crisis.
And hold on, man, because this is such a big point. What I've noticed, certainly in the mercenary world, there's a lot of competition, right? It's a knife fight in a phone booth. Everybody's trying to get, you know, Verizon and AT&T and Pure Talk. They're all going after the same consumer. It's very competitive. I was so surprised to find that same dynamic in the missionary world.
Oh, man.
I didn't think I would, but I did, you know, and there's so many great organizations out there that it just feels like they get in their own way. And I'm just making stuff up now. I don't have, it's just anecdotal, but, you know, it's like Wounded Warriors could get on the same page as Tunnel to Towers, and if Tunnel to Towers and so forth and so on, all these great organizations doing great work, but they just wind up stepping on each other.
That's right.
And they create a super noisy environment, and the average person is just like, ah, you know, whatever. So did you experience that? And I'm asking because I know the answer. Obviously, yeah. You must have. So how did you get all these other bloody do-gooders and these grassroots organizations to sing out of the same hymn book, if you will?
It's so great. Who knows, Mike? You know, we're figuring it out. No, I'm we're on this never-ending journey of not arriving, you know, so we're never going to be like, we figured it out. I would say what I loved about what you said, and this is for anyone. I mean, this is for a business. This is for anyone in the NGO space, because I'm always thinking of the listener. When you stop, when you want credit or control, you stop the viral nature of anything. So doing good should be viral, guys. Like doing good should be viral. It is contagious. It feels good when you do it. Even if you're doing a bad version of it, it's still better than doing bad, right? And it should be contagious. It should be viral. If you think about some of the faiths, you know, multiple religions have good written into their bylaws, and they spread and they grew, right? Like the early, some of the, you know, when you think about, you know, Judeo-Christian faith, like it survived because it did good. It's not because it had a great message. It had a great mission, right? It had a great mission. And I think when you want credit or control, it stops the viral nature of all of it. And so if you're to say, how do you get anyone to buy in? Well, one, we're not looking for credit or control. So the fact that I'm talking on behalf of the org, which is something we do very little, is because we don't want it to rise or fall on the ability of a person. And we're not asking everyone else, hey, we got the better idea. Come help us take your average ideas and build our idea. And everyone will know it was our idea. When we say we're nameless and faceless, so our posture in every city, and this is a fact, it's not just our posture, is we're not the hope. Like, we're not the hope, we're simply the help. We are not the hero. We are just one of the many guides. Everything this organization, Love Has No Limits, about is actually standing behind, beside, and beneath community champions, influencers, activists, to add scope and skill and sustainability. Which means the people who do get the credit are actually the incredible partners that are doing good. Like, if you want to know who's the hope of LA, it is the community champions that are never leaving LA, that have been in those backyards for 40 years, that just need a better model or more resources or greater awareness or strategic collaboration. Who's the hero of Houston? It's going to be the people of Houston, you know, born and bred, built in that city, that simply just don't know how to collaborate. And so I think when you walk in and say, guys, the point of this is at the end, what is not the point of this is at the end of this thing in LA, we're going to be on a media tour to talk about all that we did. The point of this is that everyone's going to look at a moment and we're standing on the stage, getting in the ward going, thank you, you know, for the proclamation. Like, if that was the point, everyone's done partnering with that type of model, right? But when you actually say, hey, we're going to lead the way, we're going to do the work, we're going to be behind the scenes, we're going to build the team, we're going to raise the capital, you're going to get all the credit. Because actually the credit needs to stay with the people closest to the problem, not the people farthest from the problem. That's why I always have issues when government gets credit for large outcomes. You didn't do any of that stuff. You didn't. You did not do it. The people did it. Whoever you paid actually did that. And those people should be the heroes we talk about. The people that actually did the work, you know, not that just raised the money. The people that, anyways, I could keep going on that tangent. You got me fired up on that.
It would be simple if everyone were incentivized to the same degree by the same thing. It would be simple if cookie cutter advice and bromides either served to inspire or discourage those behaviors we wish to encourage, inspire, or discourage, right? But everybody's different. And so, you know, I'm thinking, I went down there, LA, early in 21 for the first time since the lockdowns, and Chuck and I went for a walk. He lives down there. I'm up in the Republic of Marin here. And we went for a walk down through Venice. And I swear, I didn't think it was going to come back. just tense as far as you could see, you know, depravity. And it just felt lost. I point this out because around that same time, you were reaching out to Justin Bieber to see if he would do a concert. And at the same time, you were reaching out to volunteers and dangling this carrot in front of them. Hey, you can go see Justin Bieber. Here's what we need you to do on the day of. And you went to a lot of different groups with a lot of different propositions. And I can only tell you that my business partner, Mary, has a teenager. And she went, she was there literally at the same time I was flying home going, I'm pretty sure Venice is going to slide into the ocean. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure this is Old Testament stuff going on in LA right now. I just don't know how they're going to come back from this. And then there you are. Thousands, tens of thousands of people, millions of dollars being raised. So, you know, I just want people to understand that you didn't do it at the end of some rainbow. You didn't do it on a nice sunny day when all the stars lined up and everybody felt like, let's go for it. You did it in the midst of the what felt like the end of days. And it is worth leaning into that because, man, God, it was just, it seems like 1,000 years ago already, but it was just a year or two back.
Well, and if you were in the real story, I mean, we don't know if the city's going to be open. We're contracting a venue, installing it in legal reviews. I mean, to be honest, if SoFi's listening, I'm sorry you're hearing it now, just because we didn't know if you'd be able to do it. You know, the city's open, the city's closed. Are people going to come into the streets? Are people going to sign up and volunteer? You know, what's going to be our restriction? You know, so you had all of that crazy flux where you had no idea what was going to happen. But I do think what helped us is the question we started asking ourselves, Mike, is so many people ask themselves, like, what would you do if you couldn't fail, right? Like, you've heard that said before. What would you do now if you couldn't fail? And that's a decent question, but we kind of moved the question from not what would we do if we couldn't fail, but what would we do that's worth failing for? Like, that was a question we asked coming into this COVID campaign. It was, what must we be willing to fail for? And I can tell you, there was 1,000 targets created by that campaign. We hit probably 900 of them, which is awesome. There's 100 failures no one knows about because there's a lot of successes. But we were saying there has to be a new model. Like, when it comes to outreach, or if you're in the faith world, missions, as some people would call it, or when it comes to, you know, just any social good, like, we're sitting there going, it's not working. We have tons of money being spent and our cities are worse off than we were before. You know, like, it's not working. So what would be worth fighting for or failing for, you know, that if you did fail, it was, and that was what LA was. Like, we leveraged everything and previous reputations, and but we just thought, and I also say, like, we had never been focused on America, but, you know, for us that live in this country, like, this is, America's become a primary focus of what I would call missions or outreach. The need here is extremely great, greater than it's ever been, in my opinion. And so we're just saying, what's going to be this new model that actually produces transformation, you know, and how are we going to, and we can't wait for a government. We can't wait for a handout. We can't wait for the welfare system. Like, we have the power within our communities to solve these problems right now. And the best way to solve them is from the bottom up, you know, because as I've said, I think before on the podcast already, people closest to the problem, best position to solve it. You know, they were best positioned, you know, and so that was kind of this community model. It wasn't coming in going, hey, let's raise money for vaccines in some other country. Or I watched some other charitable, and I just want to be so careful because I love anyone doing anything in the name of good. But I'm also just going, is it best? But I watched this other great organization that raises significant capital, and they give that capital away, and it has entertainment value. So I'm just trying to be as very broad as possible so people can't really figure it out, but they could if they tried. And I'm watching one of their events, you know, and I was studying it. And on these events, it is the leader of a bank coming up and saying, we're committing this amount of money. And is a city leader saying, we're giving this amount of money. And all of the segments are all of these big institutions and organizations, I'm glad they're doing good. You know, there's not like they're losing money and they're going, we're giving this. And I go, there's not, when I watched it, I go, who's the community champion?
Like, who's the recipient of the money? Like, I don't care what brand or what national conglomerate or what Fortune 100 company is giving money. Who's doing the work? And what is that work producing? Because the heroes are not the people that simply cut the checks. You know, the heroes are the ones that doing the dirty work day in and day out, you know? So we got to see it from that way, because then if we do, we'll invest in it and we'll back it.
It's such a delicate balance, this whole business of virtue, because the minute you put signal after that word, then we have exactly what you've described. But we need press. We need PR. It makes very little sense for you guys to simply build a monument to yourselves, right? It'd be like preaching to the choir every single week. You've got to get outside of the sanctuary into the place where, in your case, right, the families are actually in crisis. And so how do you tell your own story without patting yourself on the back, right? How do you get it past the water's edge without becoming this very thing that you don't want to become? You don't want the spotlight on you.
Ever.
But I'm sorry, brother. You know, you.
Well, it could be on you. You know, like, that's why what I loved about L.A. Here's what's so cool about L.A. is people didn't know who did it. You know, like I still in ruins all the time and people go, hey, that thing that Justin Bieber did or that thing that Chance did or the thing that, you know, that one faith community that showed up big did or the thing that the county of L.A. did. That's the point. Like, the point is own it. Take credit for it. Like, if everyone thinks it's everyone else's thing, then it's inherently not just one single person thing. And that actually works. You know, you want to package it.
Here's my big fear.
Okay.
I hope I'm not getting it into an awkward spot, but.
No, I like it.
When I first looked at your organization, I thought, you know, one big day of service, a big celebrity, a big star, a bunch of people coming together doing something. The cynical part, or maybe just the part that had lived through something similar, said, now what?
Exactly. Like,
what next? So much PR like leads up to an event. I remember trying to get a bunch of farmers together from both the poultry industry and the meat industry and wheat and all the growers of food in the same room, because farmers are under assault. And I was very interested in doing something to help the plight of the modern farmer. But the infighting among those organizations was such that we simply couldn't get past this idea. I think it was called Table for Millions. We'll do one big event, a table for millions, and then we'll be done. And I'm like, I don't want to do that. You know, to me, the real initiative begins the day after the event.
That's right.
So that's what I'm curious about now. You raised hundreds of millions of dollars for people who desperately need it. Is there a plan to tell their stories? And how do you capitalize on the event once it's in the rearview mirror?
Yeah, I think so for us, and it's a great question. If you were saying, hey, this is a one and done or a one-off, I would just go back to making money and be with my four beautiful babies and my wife, right? Like, I can't leverage my life for that. You know, like, we want sustainable fruit. I always tell people, I know how to give you a great photo, but I want great fruit. We want a return on investment. So we don't build towards a finish line. We're building towards a starting line. So the public facing value, these see an inflection point called this one day and tens of thousands of people. I think in Houston, we had 219 service locations where you could get millions of dollars of practical aid. It was beautification projects. It was brand new soccer fields. It was medical clinics. It was prescription glass distribution. Like, there is thousands of things happening in a single day, but that is an inflection point of what the city experiences that is living off of a network of community champions that have aligned to do good long-term. You know, so when we think about America, and we think about, let's just use two classes, because we could do businesses and entities, but let's just move faith communities, which I think covers a lot of groups, right? That's every faith that has a community. And if you were to say NGOs, let's just use these two subgroups. We see faith communities and NGOs in America as an unempowered, unconnected energy grid. That's what we see them. And very similar to get the picture for our listeners, it would be very similar to what Solar City is to Tesla. And when Elon got involved and started dumping billions of capital, raising capital, buying land, developing infrastructure, creating technology, harnessing the sun in essence, he created an energy grid that allowed a vehicle to be plugged in anywhere across America. And when we look at what we want to do in these cities and eventually in this nation, it's turn on this energy grid of good. But the challenge is these different entities don't know each other. They don't talk to each other. They don't know where they can make the greatest difference. So that's the challenge. The good news is we don't have to buy land. We don't have to build buildings. We don't have to raise billions of dollars. We don't have to find a volunteer army that says do good or love your neighbor. That narrative, that bylaw is in 99% of all faiths. And the 1% it's not in are the weird ones. I'll just let you know, stay away from it. If you have a faith that doesn't say love your neighbor, get far away. But all the rest of them, actually have that. So we sit there and go, that the good news is faith communities and NGOs are the most strategically positioned and leveraged entity in America to create a compound multiplier of social good. It just has not been able to connect to each other or turn on. And so when you think about what we did in LA and even better in Houston, because we weren't into COVID, you know, we're in the great nation of Texas. We're not in a COVID pandemic. It's not our first time doing it. And we're just learning. Right. We sat there and said, our job is to create an unbelievable energy grid, faith communities, NGOs, community champions that are collectively tackling this problem together. And that is behind the one day Houston moment or the one day. So right now in Houston, there's like over 350 orgs that have agreed on serving and solving one specific problem, you know, and they've picked five of them. So, hey, we got this, you know, refugee crisis. We have an issue with the next generation in schools. We have families in poverty and families in crisis. We have child welfare. And so if you can imagine in our model, you're going to have 50 or 60 maybe churches, NGOs that have never worked together, talked to each other, now going, I am standing behind this best-in-class nonprofit who serves this problem better than everyone else, who simply needs more volunteers or resources or awareness or whatever it is, wraparound support. And will we agree to run this play together? And so, I mean, that grid lives right now. And I mean, Houston, we've called it internally, like this is our lab, because there's such energy and connectivity around, yes, we have collective might to accomplish these outcomes together and build a better future for our children's children, you know, that's what's living off of the one day. And so people go, oh, what's the sustainable aftermath? It's the fact that we have, you know, five initiatives that have long-term adoptions to actually solve the problem. And the most brilliant minds and some of the brilliant bank accounts think this is how we do it. And let's try, you know?
Well, speaking of brilliant minds and brilliant bank accounts, I remember talking to Charles Koch about before Stand Together became Stand Together. And full disclosure, I know they support your organization. They support my organization. And I think, I can't speak for him, but I've interviewed him enough to know that he looks at some people like grout, right? Like the connective tissue between tiles. I really love that. If you think about a mosaic or a wall with tile on it without grout, it all just falls to pieces. It's got nothing to stick to. So the organizations that he tends to gravitate toward and that earn his support are exactly like yours. And you're probably too young to remember this guy. Well, I'm sure you remember President Bush, but do you remember the speech he gave, the first one, when he talked about 1,000 points of light? Somebody asked him about the future of decency and the best hope in the country.
Come on.
I'm telling you, man, you are singing his song. And he's like, look, he didn't use the word top-down solution, but he was basically saying our government can only do what it can do from the top down. So the guts of it, the country, isn't tile, it's grout. And there are 1,000 points of light out there, and nothing is connecting them except the light that they generate themselves. I think what you're doing, Jedediah, fantastic name, by the way. Jeez whiz. You're the only Jedediah I know. Jedediah. Getting those lights under an umbrella, getting them connected. That's the job.
And it creates that light picture, the 1,000 points of lights, that's 100%. And I'm sorry because it's so clear in my head, but that's how I see it. And it's when you do good well, because if you do good well, it empowers people, right? So there's a lot of good that people leave the soup kitchen or the clothing line and their head's still down. and they have no other option to make their life better. So they might experience what looks like a beacon of light, but they don't in turn become a beacon of light because they never really found dignity or hope or personal value. And so when we think about the framework of doing good, you should be delivering dignity. That's what you're delivering. You're delivering hope. Now, it might be packaged in a resource or, you know, this part of the campaign, but if you do it that way, imagine you have an NGO, a nonprofit, and you have a faith community that don't believe the same thing theologically, but they want the same outcome for their city.
That's what I want to talk about.
There's a light.
That's it.
Yeah. Put them together, makes a brighter light. And then the person that they actually serve doesn't stay dark and dim. That now becomes a light. Because at the end of the day, man, if we're going to get our cities back, we have to get our communities back. If we're going to get our communities back, we got to get our families back. You know, and so when you can empower every family to be a source of light in its own community, then that is the multiplier, and that is it. And I would say one last thing. I know you got a question here, Mike. A thing that I learned in LA, which I just haven't stopped saying, when the reason why love is the lens is that when you love something or assign love to it, love comes with it assumed value. So for example, I love my parents. My mom and dad are so different than me, drastically different, think differently. We're so different. A lot of parallels, but so different. But I love them. So because I love them, their differences are allowed to live around me, and I have assigned value to them, right? Although we disagree, it doesn't remove value. And the reality is when we begin to look at, and this is what I encourage all Americans, all humans to do, is begin to look at the world around you through the lens of love, which means I've assigned value. So when I see the homeless, who's not just a homeless person, or for some people, a human speed bump, it's actually an individual who has a name and a person. When I actually see them through the lens of love, I value them, which means I give them dignity. When I see an orphan through the lens of love, there's value and now there's dignity. When I see someone with what would be a quote unquote disability through the lens of love, I value them. When I see someone who votes different than me, but through the lens of love, I've assigned value, which creates dignity. And when I think people that quote unquote have faith have lost is dignity. Is actually representing themselves with dignity and being able to give dignity. Like we've lost that art.
Look, I think words like dignity and integrity and honor, they still matter. They get thrown around a lot. I'm not sure how much time people spend really, really cogitating and ruminating on it. But as a man of faith, do you care in this endeavor that you're currently immersed? Do you care why people do good things?
Like overall, like at the mass consensus, the consensus or on the individual level, like for specific people or for generalizations?
Well, no, on the nonprofit level, on the organizational level. And look, as you formulate an answer, just know I'm asking because I was surprised again and again on returning the favor to see how many people that I good-naturedly refer to as bloody do-gooders
I love that.
Are doing what they do for reasons that they themselves would call selfish. Mm. They're doing it because it makes them feel good and right and whole to do it. Mm. A happy consequence of their doing is an improvement in the quality of the life of the person that they're assisting. But their motivation, Jedediah, is not rooted in, I'm going to save you or I want to help you. It's, hey, this is who I am and this is what I do. And now you're a family in crisis and you're in my lane. So guess what? You're going to be the object of my attention. Yeah. As opposed to, are we being called to save the world, or are we free agents out there on our own deciding, this makes me feel good to call Justin Bieber during a lockdown and organize a giant concert? I'm just wondering.
Yeah, I think I can answer. I can answer how I feel because it's so different than all those answers. I'm just I would say at face value, I do not. Now, I would be speaking individually, not organizationally. We've leveraged all types of incentives that people want so that we can get the right type of good done. You know, there's brand partners. You know, we have a lot of people, because we're nameless and faceless, that don't want to be named, which is unbelievable. We have people that have funded things that have a brand that should get awareness, but they've actually hidden their brand so other brands in that city could win. But for me, I mean, you're dealing with governments, right? You're dealing with entrepreneurs, you're dealing with investors, you're dealing with humans. And for them, like, we know how to make it a brand win. I mean, it's like, Houston was $100 million of social good. Like, who, what brand would not want to be attached to it? Now, we might be selective on what brands we let get credit, like, but I don't care initially. And I also think of, I'd rather be people connected to doing good for the wrong reasons than doing bad for the right reasons. You know, like, because I think you still have good in your equation, which has the potential to get you to more good, right? Like,
but this is, look, this is still the essential challenge of a guy like me who sees himself as an avatar, who wants to help get a little more publicity on an organization that's run by a guy who really doesn't want any credit or any publicity. Okay, you can see the tautology in which I find myself engaged. We're an hour and 6 minutes into this completely unscripted and absolutely riveting conversation, and you finally got around to the point of mentioning that your one-day event in Houston generated over $100 million in actionable social good. So far be it for me to offer advice to anybody, Jedediah, but you buried the lead. The needle is moving. People need to know. Yeah, they need to know that there's an organization that doesn't want any credit for anything called Love Has No Limits. And every now and then they show up and they throw a party. They raise over $100 million. And many, many, many families in crisis are suddenly experiencing something that looks a lot like improvement. There. Yeah. If you won't say it, I will.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Obviously, you know what I'm going to say is that I want you to love the idea of it more than the individuals connected to it. Because you don't have to wait for Love Has No Limit. You know, we have some audacious goals, but you don't have to wait till this movement, quote unquote, brings what we would call like a flagship into your city. You know, I mean, Miami's next, Chicago, New York. There's a reason why we're focused on the five biggest cities in America, which also have the worst statistics, you know, in America when it comes to social, like, this is a fact. But for us, I would rather, what am I going to do? Like, please join us. Join the movement. Follow Love Has No Limits. I don't care if you follow me. Go to the websites. But what could you do in your community right now? If you're wanting to do good, what would it look like if you did good and didn't get the credit? I can just tell you, you'd be able to do more of it if you don't want credit or control. Like, if you're sitting here wanting to do good, I would say don't wait. Like, don't wait. Just start, you know, like, fine. And then, of course, I would say for everyone who has a nonprofit or is doing good, let's not reinvent the wheel and create 1,000 versions of the same thing in the same backyard. Like, if there's someone doing it better than me, have the humility to just go build their thing. I mean, I have tons of college students and young kids that reach out to us and know what we're doing kind of and go, hey, I want to be an inspiring philanthropist or an entrepreneur. I want to step into the human trafficking space. And my advice to every one of them is, here's someone who does it, go learn from them. And if you can't do it better than them, just build what they're building. I would rather that get into our culture. And of course, if you're a person listening to this podcast and everything is selfish intentions, I would just say, try some good stuff, you know, like try some good stuff and see what it feels like. Yeah, you're right. It's a really hard narrative, you know, and I'm sorry I made it hard on your team on all these pre-calls, you know, because
no,
I'm just
I'm sorry. I had no idea. My team talked to you 3 times before you came on the podcast. I didn't know. I just literally learned that today.
We did 17 pre-podcasts before this podcast, you know, which is great. Please. 17.
This is the part where I learned.
Here's what I want our listeners to know. There is hope.
Yes.
You know, like, I want listeners to know there's hope. Like, right now, first of all, there are some incredible people probably in your city that could help you get out of a circumstance, a situation, could empower you in... Just start looking, like literally, like just start looking. Second of all, I don't believe, I see all the oppositions when it comes to our country. I have a completely different look on what's going to happen over these next 10 years. You know, I think we're going to be a part of the greatest turnaround in America's history. I think we're going to see massive long-term city transformation from the bottom up, and that is worth risking everything for. I got 4 kids, you know? So when you talk about why I do all that we do, and people's motives, like, I didn't feel special about LA. Like, we don't go in a room and pat our backs. Like, I'm just like, how can I make my passion, if you could fill it through the screen or those listening, how do I make the most of these minutes? This is fleeting. This is not forever. You know, on the run to LA, I almost died twice. It's another story. I totaled my Tesla. I literally thought I was going to, totaled a car, all over a freeway, flipped, turned. I mean, I thought I was dying. Like, in all honesty, I want to be honest, I said, I love you, God. Closed my eyes. My spirit said, I'll see you in a second. I haven't shared this publicly, so being very transparent with this room, this audience. I said, see you in a second. And I concluded this was my last minutes, guys. It was it. Like, that was it. And I lived. I went home like at 3 a.m. that night. I cried with my kids. I cried in the showers like the movies. Like, I'd be like, I'm alive. Like, God, I'm here. Like, I mean, I cried for days. Like, just, and then so I sometimes set some candles and some music to make it like the movie. And I was in the shower and the steam's going. I'm like, ah. I was frail. I had legitimate trauma. It's the first time I had created a greater sensitivity to people with trauma because I couldn't function the way I used to function. Like, I was in a donor room with hundreds of extremely wealthy individuals 3 days later, and I hid, and I'm a very social person. And I remember going to my wife and to the team. I go, guys, I got a second shot at life. I can do anything. I could leave this org. I could just go back to making money in businesses. I could just do, and you guys would all be okay with it. Cause I had like this, you know, this life crisis and this reality with death. And I looked at my team, I looked at my wife and I go, I just want to double down on what we're doing. But I do know this might be my last conversation today of value. I don't think it is, but when you've tasted, when you've seen death that close, and at the end of the day, like, we're all fighting this clock. We don't know. Here's what we do know. If you've done the surveys, we all die. 10 out of 10, right? 10 out of 10 unbearable survey statistics. Survey says we all die. So all I'm sitting there saying, well, how are we going to do something that actually matters? And I don't care. The dream would be that there's so much good and change in statistics that no longer exist. My dream, and no one would know we had this conversation, and no one would know we might have touched a small part of it. You know, like, that would be the dream.
When was the accident, Jedediah?
2021, January.
Before Love Has No Limits? Before the event?
Before Love Has No Limits, yeah. It was a lot of unique energy around that time.
Holy crap, you buried another lead.
And to be honest, just how crazy my brain is, I was like, if this is what needs to happen for this thing to take place, trust me, my wife's heard me say it and she hates me for it. I was like, I'm good. Mm. Like, I remember my mom goes, why did you say I love you? Like, this is what I said, guys. I know I'm not trying to be a weird spiritual guy, religious. I'm just real. And she said, why'd you not cuss or freak out or save me? Like, the car is spinning, guys. I'm getting hit on both sides. Oh. I go across 5 lanes on the 10, completely total my car. I have to get ripped out of it. Because I've always believed in my faith narrative that whether a lifetime or legacy, everything God's promised me is going to come to pass. It doesn't need to happen in my lifetime. It just needs to happen in my legacy. And I'm convinced that those things that are promised to me are going to come to pass. Whether I see it from this planet or I see it from what's next, it's going to happen. So yeah. I remember in that moment going, if this is the way providence and divinity finds it best for my life to finish, to achieve a greater result and outcome, I was actually at peace. Like, that car was going, and I was at peace with the death moment, being like, well, it's going to be hard on my kids, but I just believe it's going to be good. You know, it's going to happen. And yes, so when you think about these are fleeting moments and minutes, no one's going to talk about the stuff you did for yourself, man. No one goes to a funeral and talks about what that individual did for themselves, right? Think about
it. Gosh, he was really in shape. Boy, yeah. Boy, was he in good shape.
He had his daily greens and, you know, like, no one did CrossFit like him, and he was best on his retirement portfolio, and he collected so many assets, and, you know, he really knew how to change a tire. Like, no one talks about what you can do for yourself. Everyone, like, the great funerals, unless you were just a jerk, they all talk about what this human being did for others. You know, so like the stuff that's going to matter is what we do for others, not for ourselves.
Right. I mean, there's obviously a lot of faith and hope and love in everything that you just said. But there's also a dynamic that I think can be experienced really by anyone who's bipedal, who's simply living. You know, I call it the theory of bonus time. Mm. Like, when you have a near miss like that, something happens. If you're a sane, sentient person, over the next, it could be hours, days, weeks, or months, but everything, the flowers smell sweeter, the pancakes taste better, everything from a banal TV show to sex, everything is better when you're in bonus time, you know, and
so right.
and that
so good.
And there you are. You're getting pulled out of what's left of your Tesla. You've made your peace, and now you still have these giant occasions looming in front of you. It must have been impossibly buoyant, to right? I mean, you must have just been floating through these things.
I think the coolest thing, that's probably the wrong words, but something you said that's going to impact me forever is this bonus time thought. And if we could create a mind hack, which it's actually the truth, but if you could wake up and consider today a bonus day, instead of saying, you know, people always say, live like it's your last day on earth. Well, you do a lot of crazy things if it's your last day on earth. There's no right. stewardship if it's your last day on earth. You're probably making a lot of mistakes if you're last day on earth. You probably don't have any money left at the end of that 24-hour period if it's your last day on earth. So I've always wrestled with live like it's your last day. Like, I want to have that ethos, but I've wrestled with it. But when you just identified, because I know what that felt like. I know what the bonus day felt like, Mike. And if we could wake up and go, this is a bonus day.
Could I have a
like bonus? This is, I mean, first of all, my mind's cognitively processing. I got mobility in my legs. I have blood in my veins. I have breath in my lungs. Like, I have, if you're in America, you most likely have transportation and a television and like stuff that, you know, most of the world doesn't have. Like, and this is a bonus day. This is a bonus day with my kids, a bonus day with my wife. I get to go to work. I didn't, you know,
it's a snow day.
That's powerful. Let's just create every day to be our bonus day.
If you're 12 years old, that's called a snow day.
It's a snow day.
It wasn't scheduled, but it snowed. And guess
so
what?
Good.
No one's going anywhere today, you know?
That's so good.
Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to remember. And it's something you said, but it's not from this conversation, so I'm going to ask you to say it anyway. I heard you give a sermon in Gainesville.
In my old life.
In your old life. And you referenced a study that I had heard about, but had totally forgotten about. And I think you were talking about the nature of hope.
Is this the current, yeah, and Scott Ritter story?
Ritter. It's yep. the story of Ritter. Could you just like put that in a nutshell for our listeners?
Because I want to get to exact stats. So you're going to have to do your own due diligence, and I probably could just look it up for a second to get the exact numbers, but this is in the 1950s. Ritter was a John Hopkins scientist, and at that period of time, and everyone listening, please do your due diligence. I haven't been prepared to communicate on this intelligently, and I'm going from memory. I've communicated a few times publicly. Don't always get my details.
The way it's called The Way I Heard It. Okay. It doesn't matter.
So good.
The disclaimer's built in.
The way we heard it. So he wants to find out, like a lot of scientists do, about some information that everyone cares about. And that was the average life expectancy of a rat swimming in a bucket of recycled water. So the correct terms was the average life expectancy of a rat swimming in a bucket of recycled water, and this is in the 50s. And as Ritter and his team are doing the study, they quickly find out that the average life expectancy of every single rat, is about 15 minutes. Swim as long as they can, they absolutely die. Swim as long as they can, they die. And then they change the study, which is amazing, and they add one little layer. That layer is they pull the rat out, they dry that rat off, that little rat, they let that rat rest for minutes. This is not hours, this is not tens of minutes, it's minutes, probably 5-6 minutes. And then they put that rat back into the bucket of water. And if I remember correctly, and of course I'd love our listeners to pause. We're gonna go to a commercial break, stay tuned, we'll be right back. We'll be right back. But if you ask, the question was, well, how long did the second rat keep swimming? You know, and a lot of people, like in these moments, would be like 30 minutes, 40 minutes. And I believe it was, I think it was like 40 something hours, 60 hours. Okay.
I remember, it
was like 60 hours, 40 something, yeah. 60 hours. And it was like 427 times longer than the initial rat. Guys, every rat died at 15 minutes. These rats swam for hours. And the only logical conclusion that science could come up with between the rat that swam for 15 minutes and the rat that swam 436 times longer was the fact that the second rat had been pulled out of the water, dried off. In essence, it had been rescued. It had experience being rescued. So when it got put back into the water, it had hope for a rescuer to come again. The difference between the rat at 15 minutes and the rat at 40, 60 hours, at 47 hours, was the fact that it had hope. It had hope. A reason to live. It knew a reason to live. And yeah, that is, well, I keep thinking, yeah, you brought it up, but that is, especially I think, and we're not all, you know, we're still in the trauma from the pandemic, but at the end of the day, if you don't have hope, I hope we could be a source of some of that today. And if you need to find hope, there's a lot of communities that would love to help you, you know?
Well, look, man, yes. Yeah. 1,000 times. Yes. You show people that it's possible to boil the ocean, to take a big swing, to move the needle in a meaningful way. I'm not trying to give you credit. I'm just trying to point it out because it's important. It's important, Jedediah, in the same way that Roger Bannister was so important to the species. It's not that he broke the 4-minute mile. It's that he did it first. He did it at a time when no one thought it could be done. And then, since then, how many hundreds, thousands of people have done the 4-minute mile? Somebody's going to do the 3-minute mile one of these days. We're going to be as gobsmacked by that as we were by the other. Surely as gobsmacked as a rat who we know has 15 minutes before he just gives up versus 60 hours. So that's why it's important to tell your story, brother. Whether you tell it or get somebody decent in the PR world or just, it has to be out there because whether you like it or not, you could be the 60-hour rat. You could be the next 3-minute mile guy. And what that's going to do for people is give them hope.
That was the dream, Mike, so thank you for that. And I receive it. And the dream, I'll never forget. You have these different things you run towards and out, you know, in these different campaigns. And I never forget L.A. I started telling our team, this is our Mars shot. And I studied a lot of Elon, so I'm apologize for referencing him so much. I just love disruptors, right? I just love disruptors. So I've also studied MLK and Gandhi and, you know, all these guys. But I go, it's our Mars shot. And they go, what do you mean our Mars shot? And I started talking about when Elon, who would be honest, when he was starting early on going to Mars, and they were saying, what do you want to do? Prove life? Now it's change. But do you want to prove life on Mars, build business on Mars, you know, create transport to Mars? And he said, I'm not trying to accomplish anything with getting to Mars. He's like, that was when he was working on that Entane capsule, which had soil and a seed so that he could grow this incredible grass and flowers. Yeah, he's like, I want to get one photo, which is this lush green landscape in front of this red dirt mountain Mars backdrop. And he goes, and that one photo is going to inspire everyone else to figure out how we're going to get there and build trade and build commerce. And to be honest, that was what LA was. It was not, how do we do this 1,000 times? It's, could we inspire to, I think, a lot of people and probably a lot in the faith community at that time, a different way to do good. And I will tell you what we've learned, and this is true to humanity, is probably what Elon learned when he was taking this multi-planetary journey to space, where he thought everyone had given up on hope for what could happen or what could be there. He thought they had just given up on the possibility of going. And as you know, in all the interviews, you probably heard him, he quickly realized no one had given up. They just had concluded there wasn't a way. So when I think about faith communities, people of faith, people that want to do good, you know, recovery communities, what I've realized is I used to think, oh, you've just given up. You no longer have passion to help people. And what I found out is no, there's tons of passion all over, and it's in different races and different faces and different political parties, and there's a passion to do good, but the mass consensus, as they've just included, it's not possible. So if you say we swung for the fence and we created a snapshot of what's possible, and that in turn means a bunch of people will go pursue it, man, that's worth an hour and a half convo right here.
Well, you know what? Here's where I'll land the plane. When you were talking earlier, and again, this is just another way to pay you a similar compliment in a slightly different way, but maybe that wreck on the 10 before that event in L.A., at the height of the lockdown, when the world was probably about at the darkest place it could be, all things considered, what do you decide to do next? You're going to Houston, New York,
Chicago,
Miami. If there were a Russian judge on this podcast right now, and they were ranking the degree of difficulty for the dive that you just took, it'd be 10. I don't know how you're going to execute it. But when I say boil the ocean, I don't mean you're doing something beyond your ability. I mean, you are going for it. You're not going to Beverly Hills. You're not going to Orange County. You're going into the places. If you can correct the ills that we've described in those five cities alone, that transforms the country.
50% of the worst of our nation's stats when it comes to incarceration, child welfare, human trafficking, poverty, corruption, and violence. Many studies would say 50% of all of America's stats live in those five cities. So if you think about changing the narrative for the nation, if you can win in those five cities, literally half of our country's statistics on the worst of our problems can change. And then I would say to what's also there is, and being really transparent with this audience, is we got to run to failure on some stuff. Like, you want to know what humility looks like? Failing publicly consistently, right? Like, failing publicly consistently. Now, there's a lot of wins, but for us, it's like, hey, if this is not going to be the model that, you know, helps our kids in schools, right? We have a massive education crisis in America. We could go on that forever. Like, if this is not the model, what is it? And let's just keep running towards failure until we figure it out. Instead of being like, this is what we do, and I hope you like it and give money to it, and let's just keep doing it. Like, for us, we're trying to run to failure. And I also think these five cities, we didn't just, like, we kind of sensed them, to be honest. Like, we didn't get the data till after. These five cities also really represent, I think, the core cultural context of America at large. Not entirely, but of course, you have LA. This is the entertainment capital of the world. You have Houston. You know, this is middle America. You know, this is a completely different, you know, city. And it's also got, it's the most diverse city in America. You go to Miami, Miami is a whole different version, you know, of an American city, which has Latin towns and, you know, has massive Hispanic influence. It's a whole different type of city. It's also a global city. And then you go to Chicago and all those, there's inner city everywhere. Like, man, we better figure out something that works for the projects, you know, like that actually works for areas of blocks and, you know, communities that we have never really been able to crack the code on, you know, besides move you away, right? We haven't cracked the code on how do you live and stay here and thrive here. It's just move you away. And then New York, which is the financial capital of the world, basically it's a log of lessons learned that hopefully build us a use case to say, now how do we bring this to everywhere in America? And how can this be adopted without us ever having to come there, right? That's the real goal.
So good, man. I love the notion of running to failure. I was talking to a special forces guy the other day who I know who's in about the best shape you can be in. Doesn't really look like it, but he can run until he falls asleep. He runs until he gets bored, basically. But he was saying, look, the key to working out, it doesn't matter what you do. And it really doesn't matter when you do it. What matters is that you do it to failure.
Wow.
You do as many push-ups as you can, and then you rest for 3 minutes and do as many as you can. And then you rest for 3 minutes and do as many as you can, and then move on to the next thing. The important thing is that when you're done, you're lying on your face with snot bubbles and drool and just spent, finished. Run it to failure. And then rest up and do it again. Look, man, I got to be respectful of your time. You're changing the world, so you probably don't need to spend more than an hour and a half. But I sure appreciate the chance to pick your brain and see what makes a bloody do-gooder tick in these uncertain times.
Such an honor to be with you, and thank you for being a champion of humanity. As I said when I did get on, which didn't make it into the recording, it's been amazing. And obviously you're listening because you love who this man is. It's not just who he brings on. And I can say that. I mean, I'll tell you, Mike, I was in a meeting with some investors right before I came in here to do this podcast. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry, guys, I got to leave. I'm doing this Mike Rowe podcast. And this guy was just the biggest fan, you know, it like went off. I mean, he was just, and I was like, I'll tell Mike you said hi, you know, like Troy says hi to you, Mike. But it's the fact that what I love is that you've spent a lot of time, and I'm not, you know, Wikipedia to know everything you've done in your life and accomplishments, but to fight for the overlooked, the undervalued, and the marginalized. And obviously you did that in the workforce for such a long period of time, but thank you for being an incredible advocate for humanity and really, I think, calibrating how people see things and who the type of person they want to be. I can tell you, I've spent time with a lot of people. I didn't expect this experience, you know? So if you haven't seen it, guys, but I've cried today. I lost my words today. I was massively, I think, encouraged today too. Like, I don't know how you get encouraged through questions, but it resonates. And thank you for what you're doing. You're one of the great humans. You know, you're one of the great humans alive today. And I mean that. I'm not.
Come on, man. It wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't have happened without my psychopathic dog running away from me and me chasing him down the street of my otherwise sensible community in my underwear. If you're going to interview somebody you admire,
we love you, Freddie.
Probably the best.
We love you, Freddie.
Please come back.
That's going to be the name of this episode. We love you, Freddie.
He's a good boy. You know what? That's not bad. Hang on a second. He's still here. Hold on. Oh. Here he is.
We love you.
Inciting incident.
We love you, Freddie. Does he bark on command? Look at that. Back to that nose nostril looking. I mean, seriously.
He doesn't do anything on command. That's the charm of the dog. If you want him to do something, don't tell him. If you tell him to do it, just know. He's untrainable. He's unwillable.
Oh, let's change the world together, man. You're invited. We got a lot of stuff to do in Houston. Love to see you. Right. Let's dream together. Let's be friends. Thank you for your time. Freddie, you are loved, and I'm leaving here today to get a tattoo of you on my back. I'll never forget it. I won't put the names of my kids in my body, but I'll etch a sketch your face, and we'll get you on.
Look at that. Just like that, my dog's a tramp stamp. I love it.
Well, who said I was going to put it on my lower back? Like, why'd you go there? You know, you just well, assumed just, there was you know, a lower I mean, you back brought it up.
All right, man, don't hang up. We have to make sure all your wisdom has been properly uploaded. But that was terrific. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
When you leave a review, which we hope that you'll do, tell us who you are. Tell us who you are. And before you go, won't you leave 5 stars?